costs. Expand on that, Norm.
Well, again, I mean, I think that, you know, what John's commitment was to the everyday people of Mexico, he would go to places where no one else was, and he would ask everyday people, the workers, the families, you know, what's going on here? And that's how he would tell the story, and that's how he responded to all of these global issues, was to go to the bottom and look up.
Tips and tricks. You have an Appendix B of Rebel reporting for journalists.
Yeah. When we put this book together, we wanted to include something for students, because really what I hope for this book is that this will become, you know, a recommended reading for journalism students across the country. And so Catherine Comp of Free Speech Radio News and Laura Brickman, who was an intern at WRT, and I put together this appendix. It's web links, it's resources, it's something to basically take what you've learned in these lectures and get going and go out and do it yourself.
Well, I want to thank you and congratulate you on this book. You are certainly doing John Ross honor. Rebel Reporting is the book. John Ross speaks to independent journalists. It is co-edited by Norm Stockwell, who's been at WORT here in Madison, the community radio station, for 33 years. Congratulations. That does it for our program. A very happy birthday to Samin Farkindeh. And I'll be speaking tonight and Friday night in Toronto, Canada. Check our website at democracynow.org. On Saturday, I'll be in Troy, New York, at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Sunday, back in New York at the Left Forum. And on Monday, I'll be speaking at the Philadelphia Free Library. Check our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Charina Nadura. Also to all of our folks at Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Madison, Wisconsin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, As Time Goes By in Shanghai, showing Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. As Time Goes By in Shanghai tells the story of Shanghai's Peace Old Jazz Band, performing together since 1980. Aged between 65 and 87 years, many of them have been playing jazz since the 1940s and have seen the world transform. From the Japanese occupation and the Cultural Revolution to capitalism on overdrive, the band members have seen the many faces of China and withstood government's suspicion of jazz. Again, that's As Time Goes By in Shanghai, Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Two or three hours after I left church, I heard this noise, and they were saying, the dike has broken.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 27th through May 30th, celebrating the preservation of the history of Vanport and its residents. The Vanport Mosaic Festival is 4 days of art, culture, historical exhibits, lectures, and tours that will engage audiences in a deeper understanding of this chapter in Portland's history. This includes screenings of short documentary films, performances of Cottonwood in the Flood, and much, much more. Again, the Vanport Mosaic Festival is May 27th through May 30th, celebrating the preservation of the history of Vanport and its residents, taking place all over the Portland metro area. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, inviting the public to meet the finalists for the next PCC president. Forums held May 23rd through 27th at 4 campus locations. More online at pcc.edu/president search. This program has also been made possible in part by the Seattle Theater Group, presenting An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies, two evenings with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Tickets for Neil deGrasse Tyson this September go on sale this Friday, May 13th, and more information is available at portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Forest Grove student who hung a Build the Wall banner at his high school publicly apologizes.
The United Methodist Church is in the midst of controversy at their convention here in Portland.
And this weekend is the Oregon Queer Youth Summit. We speak live with young people who will be attending.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 19th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jamie Haddad. Portland is now the 26th largest city in the U.S., jumping up two places, according to the latest U.S. Census Bureau rankings. Portland gained just under 12,000 new people between 2014 and 2015. The Bend area actually grew the most in the state, with just under 3,000 new residents. Hillsborough also reached a new growth milestone, 100,000 people. The city was one of seven others across the U.S. to reach that same milestone.
A new surge of votes. Today's election update, Chloe Udaly looks set for a runoff with Portland Commissioner Steve Novick in November. The bookstore owner and housing rights advocate is battling Stuart Emmons to secure second place behind incumbent front runner Novick. Initial results on Tuesday showed that Udaly was behind by a couple of percentage points. Then on Wednesday, her deficit was only a single vote, and there was talk of a mandatory recount, but by Wednesday evening, with about 12,000 votes yet to be counted, Udaly led fellow challenger Stuart Emmons by almost 1,000 votes. And now, as of 4 o'clock this afternoon, Udaly has surged ahead by 1,500 votes. While Novick got over 60,000 votes for his Portland City Commissioner seat, he failed to win a majority. This forces a runoff during November's general election. The other commissioner up for re-election, Amanda Fritz, won her seat with a clear majority. Portland's new mayor-elect is former state treasurer Ted Wheeler.
Hundreds of students from Forest Grove and other schools walked out today in protest of a Donald Trump-inspired banner hanging in their school. The banner, which reportedly was quickly removed, read, "Build a Wall." By day's end, the student responsible for the banner issued a lengthy apology through the website of a communications professional working with the family. The student has not been named publicly, though he is known in his school and community. He says he does not support a wall being built and did not understand the negativity of the message he was sending. Responding to the banner, students from many schools were quick to organize a walkout. The banner was hung over a sign supporting a movement to end the use of the N-word at the school, a school made up of about 50% Latinos. Local TV news showed the banner and provided helicopter footage of the walkout. Forest Grove School District Chief of Staff Connie Porter said the incident was, quote, very brief and that the two students were disciplined. U.S. House Representative Susan Bonamici tweeted, quote, glad to see peaceful action against racism and intolerance, and used the hashtag StandUpFG, currently created by students concerned with the racist attack.
In Corvallis on Wednesday, more than 50 bicycle riders lined up for a silent ride to honor bicyclists who have been killed or injured on the road. The 12th annual Corvallis Ride of Silence is part of a worldwide silent ride movement that started back in 2003. Lisa Fox, whose husband Randall was killed this year in a bike race, spoke before the ride. Dozens of riders wore armbands representing injured or deceased riders. These riders hope to raise awareness of the vulnerability of cyclists who use the road while remembering and honoring the lives of their loved ones.
Members of the United Methodist Church held a vigil yesterday afternoon outside the World Conference happening in Portland. The vigil participants wanted to call attention to the church's need to divest from Israel. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with one of the demonstrators yesterday.
I'm Suzanne Hoder, and I'm co-chair of a group called United Methodist Kairos Response. It's a grassroots group within the United Methodist Church that is seeking to align the church's investments with its principles. The church has long opposed the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. We have long opposed the settlements, and we are concerned because our church agencies in some cases are holding a stock in some of the very companies that are helping to sustain and expand the settlements. So we are hoping to remove that contradiction here this week.
And what's the status of the proposed resolution for divestment here at the United Methodist Church?
Well, actually, there were four resolutions submitted by us and a number submitted by other groups as well. They ranged from divestment, call for divestment from specific companies. One was dealing with Caterpillar Corporation, and another was dealing with three companies. The other two resolutions were screening measures, and they dealt with having the church state that we would not invest in the future in illegal settlements. One was specifically related to Israeli settlements, and the other dealt with illegal settlements anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Are those being heard at this time? Have they successfully passed to the point where they may actually pass this week?
In the form that they were submitted in, I would say no. The subcommittee did not approve them for floor action. However, there are many, many supporters of this idea, and I believe that some of the hundreds of people who support us will be seeing if there are other ways to achieve the similar goals.
The resolution that did not get passed or get through the committee is divestment from Caterpillar and these investment screens.
There were four resolutions that we know of that we had brought to the conference, and those did not come through the committee in that form. However, that committee did report out a measure that we consider a very hopeful sign, and it may have a broader impact than the narrower resolutions we submitted. There is a resolution that now is commending the Board of Pensions for its past actions to disassociate itself from companies that are violating human rights. In December, they took action to sever their ties with a number of those companies. So we and the Pension Board together are supporting a measure that would commend that. The same measure would call on all, would state unequivocally that governments cannot tell churches that they can't use economic action to bring about social change. It's a key tool and has been throughout the church history to bring social change. And so governments at any level, we believe, should not be doing that. And there are other provisions in the measure that lift up economic action, that especially lift up indigenous peoples and the need to listen to the voices of indigenous people. We have service taking place right now inside the conference to apologize for what was done to Native Americans. And our missionaries and the Christians of Palestine have called on the church to use actions like divestment and boycott, which can prevent this kind of thing from happening, from continuing to happen in the future.
When will you know if this kind of wider investment screen and condemnation of human rights and occupation will in fact go through this week?
It isn't a specific condemnation of occupation, but it says that we should listen to our missionaries and indigenous voices. Our missionaries have called very specifically for the use of divestment and boycott to end Israel's occupation, but missionaries also have a broader voice on many topics.
Is there anything else that our listeners should know or ways to support what's going on here?
Our primary focus is to build on the actions that were taken by the Pension Board in the end of last year, to see more such actions and to educate and inform United Methodists about the parallels between this situation of a colonialism and dispossession and situations that we have apologized for allowing to continue in the past. So we are feeling that we're making a lot of progress with our educational efforts. And by the way, there was also a task force established by the plenary yesterday, which would seek to educate United Methodists about the realities on the ground in the Holy Land today.
The Oregon Queer Youth Summit is coming up this weekend. Hundreds of people are expected to attend, and there will be workshops, there will be speakers, and a prom. And here with us at KBOO to talk about it is organizer Clay and also Cavi and Tet-Tet. Thanks for coming in, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
So, Clay, what is important about this event?
It's an opportunity for our youth, our queer and transgender youth, to have a sense of community, as well as all these workshops that teach them and provide alternative education.
Could you talk about some of the people who will be speaking at the summit and putting on the workshops?
Yes, there's a lot of different voices that are happening. We have a youth that's speaking about the foster care system. We have youth talking about inclusion. We have this whole thing happening with the bathrooms right now. A lot of that's going to be talked about, how to keep safe by police profiling and safe in our schools. Of course, safer sex. We have, it's titled Safer Sex is Revolutionary. So many things. The difference between gender and sexuality. I could go on. There's more than 15 workshops.
And who is it that you're expecting to attend this conference?
All ages of queer and transgender youth, mostly high school age, and it's predominantly in the Portland region. Probably over 100 attendees.
Are you encouraging their parents to come also?
It's actually only for youth, yeah.
Oh, okay. Very good. And so could you tell us a little bit about the different experience that the younger group has than the adult group of
the
queer
community?
Actually
going to let them answer that question.
Okay, very good. That's Cavi and Tet-Tet.
Hello, this is Cavi. That's a hard question for me to answer. I don't know what it's exactly like to be an adult, but I do know that for youth, you know, there's a lot less choice involved. If you're living with your parents, you can't always present the way you want to present or go by the name or the pronouns that you want to go by. And I would assume that's the biggest difference.
I'm Tet-Tet, and I think my experience is different than that of queer adults because I feel like adults, well, they did grow up like in a different generation and with different experiences, and to have youth have opportunities that adults didn't have when they were growing up. I feel like that's very revolutionary and beneficial to have.
Well, what kind of things are you excited about that's coming in this summit that you want to attend and say?
Everything. I'm so excited. We've been planning so hard. And, like, they're making everything happen that we want to happen. There's going to be a chocolate fountain there. And there's going to be pastries. And there's going to be a bunch of free clothes and music and great people, amazing people who I love. It's going to be such a good day. And there's going to be, like, a bunch of chips and salsa.
Yeah, also, Cavi and me are planning on hosting a workshop about zines, making zines about our ex-queerians.
And seed bumps.
And seed bumps.
Yeah, which I'm really excited about.
Well, describe some of the workshops that you expect to happen and what they're about, how they're going to work.
Well, our theme is plants as a metaphor for revolution. And a lot of people went off of that like theme, but mine and Tet-Tet's is seed bombs, and we're gonna like make these like little balls of seeds to throw all around Portland. So there's like essentially gonna be like food growing everywhere when we throw our bombs, and it's just gonna be, it's gonna be great. What?
A queer takeover.
Oh yeah, queer takeover with food and vegetables and lots of art. And there's gonna be one that is about witchcraft, which is really cool and I'm excited for. There's seriously so much stuff. There's a lot of body positivity things also through like art and things like that.
I think another important thing to mention about the summit is that when we say queer youth, we mean like people who are 25 and under.
Yeah, it's a pretty loose definition of youth.
Well, yeah, you can't really define it that specifically. But what do you think are some of the issues that you have faced and that you're going to address during this summit?
I can speak as a parent, as a queer parent, and I have a 9-year-old who is also transgender who I will have attending the workshops, that it's really difficult to help trans youth navigate through education when their identity isn't accepted or space isn't held for them. And so the learning can't even begin because so much of their identity is erased or hated, that they fear being attacked. So that is something that's really important for me as a parent, to know that my own child will be receiving lots of warmth from a community, but also lots of education on how to stay safe, and also like ways to do self-care. That was another workshop. Mm-hmm. So if anyone else for the youth want to speak to.
I feel like as a queer person of color, a lot of things about myself like are ignored. Like I went to a middle school that was predominantly people of color, but the queer part of me was not accepted there. Now I go to a school that's very open to folks being queer, and the person of color, like that is me, is like also ignored there. And I go to conferences, multiple conferences, and like one aspect will always be ignored about me. And to have like intersectionality at anywhere is very helpful for me as a youth, especially like just finding my way. And as a person of color and being queer and being trans, it's a lot of little things. And going to the Queer Youth Summit last year was very helpful, because not only do we talk about being POC and being queer, we talk about like, you know, what it's like to be an immigrant, what it's like to be trans, and what it's like to be queer, what it's like to be queer and trans, a lot of intersectionality.
You had asked me about what issues we're facing, and I think it's a time for us to organize, because we're the least documented as far as murders every day. There's actually been more murders of queer and trans people than people of color since the year began. And so we need to find a way to keep each other safe. And I just found out 10 minutes ago that there's a meeting of the Methodist Church here in Portland, and they're at the convention center deciding if being queer is okay. And I don't know what it will come of them deciding if we're not, and like what repercussions will happen. So it's a time of us keeping each other safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be the main issue that they're talking about. So you are on the front page right there.
Yeah.
With the big organization. And so your experience, I'm talking to Cavi and Tet-Tet, have you found any help at all with authority figures, like in the schools, with your teachers, with churches, with any adults out there who could help you? Have they ever done so?
Well, we both go to a school that's very small. It's about 110 high schoolers, and it's very queer and very accepting. And I've gone there since kindergarten, so there's always been very supportive adults, and we've got a great QSA going on. So yeah, I my teachers are so great and queer and awesome. Like our principal and vice principal are like pretty queer. So
well, that's great. I mean, that's great to hear.
No, yeah, we're lucky. Yeah. We are so lucky.
That's not the norm.
Yeah, it's not at all.
So one other question about the summit. A prom is mentioned. So tell us about this prom. Sounds interesting.
That's where the chocolate fountain is.
Yeah.
The chocolate fountain.
So we're doing this thing at the Queer Youth Summit where we will also be hosting a clothing swap throughout the whole duration of the event. So basically, we will also room. So if folks come and they see something that they want to wear, especially to like prom or something, like not a lot of people have clothing. So like that just ties into what we're doing at prom, like having a clothing swap and giving people the opportunity to dress up if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Well, also it's really important to have an opportunity for a specifically queer prom, because like I just recently read an article where a lesbian was kicked out of her senior prom for wearing a suit, and it's like we need these inclusive spaces where it's not a taboo for us to go to prom, and it's just a prom, and it's just safe for us. So, yeah, that's really the whole point of having our queer prom.
Well, I have great hopes for it. Could you tell us where it's going to be?
It's at the Native American Youth and Family Center, and it's at 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard on this Saturday.
Columbia Boulevard, that's different than Columbia Street. Yeah. It's confusing here in Portland. Very good. Well, is there anything that you are especially proud of in setting up and organizing and creating this thing, this summit, this big event?
Oh, boy. I am just so proud of every single person putting work into this event. There's been so many people just rallying and getting it all together. And yeah, I don't even know what specifically to say I'm proud of, but everybody's just so amazing. I'm proud of everyone. I'm proud of myself.
Well, I have to say I am too. I think this is great. You guys are doing all this. Well, that about wraps it up. I thank you so much for coming, Tet-Tet, Cavi, and Clay, and telling us about this event that's coming up. And if people want to learn more about what's happening with this Youth Summit, it's going to be happening Saturday, May 21st. That's 2 days from now, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's a whole 8 hours. The prom will run after that from 7 to 10 p.m. You can find more about it online, and you can register if you want to, at www.oqys.org. Thanks again, everybody.
Earlier this afternoon, two workers from the Burgerville Workers Union visited the Portland office of the Franz Bread Company. Franz is the largest bread supplier to Burgerville. Representatives from the Burgerville Workers Union say they're looking forward to beginning an amicable relationship with the local company.
More news on the United Methodist Church. By a 23-vote margin, the church kept the peace at their convention in Portland yesterday, staying unified for now. The church's delegates narrowly passed a proposal from its Council of Bishops to take steps to resolve the LGBTQI inclusion issue and to stay together as a single denomination. Those steps include appointing a special commission to discuss whether to accept same-sex marriage and to ordain LGBTQI clergy and to possibly hold an extra world conference in the year 2018 or 19 to discuss a possible split of the denomination. These steps were taken in conjunction with removing explosive anti-gay proposals due to come to the floor yesterday. Both conservative and liberal factions in the church might be in favor of a split. Other moderates and self-expressed heartbroken church members would like to stay together. A split ought to be the goal, said Dorothy Benz, a New York delegate and LGBTQI activist. 7 million of the United Methodist Church's 12.8 million members are Americans. In the southern United States and in Africa, members generally are conservative on the LGBTQI issue, while most other Americans favor inclusion. The United States Supreme Court's decision to legalize same-sex marriage last year put pressure on the Methodists to be more LGBTQI inclusive. Demonstrations at the Oregon Convention Center by pro-LGBTQI activists, the coming out last week by 111 Methodist ministers, and a letter signed by 2,300 allies of the activists have all put pressure on the delegates to change their human sexuality policies.
A Northwest watchdog claims that an energy company has received a lease to build an unsafe liquefied natural gas plant in Tacoma, Washington. The Sightline Institute's report details the flaws in Puget Sound's energy plan to build a multi-use clean energy site to deliver liquefied natural gas, or LNG. PSE already owns a nearby LNG storage site, but is inexperienced in LNG production. The proposed Tacoma site, recently approved by the Tacoma Port Commission, would primarily produce natural gas to fuel ships and hauling trucks. A secondary and much more minor function of the site would be to provide natural gas to resident customers on peak demand days. Northwest industry watchdogs cite several reasons for community members and concerned groups to push back before the facility's targeted opening in 2019. Concerns include the unsuitable conditions of Port Tacoma for such a plant, PSE's inexperience producing LNG, LNG, and gaps in regulation of bunkering, the process of fueling ships with LNG.
According to the Oregon Environmental Council's sobering new infographic, What's in Our Air?, breathing comes at a sinister cost. The first graphic illustrates contributing sources to poor air quality, things like old diesel engine trucks that remain in use well past their prime, and the emissions of large construction equipment. The state of Oregon is not on track to meet its emission-reducing goals. Another one of the graphics criticizes the state's environmental regulatory shortcomings and suggests improvements to them. There are, in fact, only 3 air quality monitors in the entire state of Oregon. This number seems especially unsettling after toxic hotspots were discovered in both North and Southeast Portland. Since then, the DEC has promised to conduct surprise air quality testing at local businesses.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland with Sequoyah Wright. Tomorrow's weather is partially cloudy, with highs around 68 degrees. Today in history, in 2006, a UN panel joined world leaders in urging the Bush administration to close its prison in Guantanamo Bay, saying the indefinite detention of terror suspects there violated the world's ban on torture. The quote of the day is from James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State, who said, "It gives us a very, very bad name, not just internationally. I have a great deal of difficulty understanding how we can hold someone, pick someone up, particularly someone who might be an American citizen, even if they were caught somewhere abroad, acting against American interests, and hold them without ever giving them an opportunity to appear before a magistrate."
Oh, look, it's 31 minutes after 5 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Pouty, whiny, spoiled bratism is not nice coming from a 4-year-old, but it's grotesque when it comes from billion-dollar corporate elites like Uber and Lyft. The two far-hire car companies call their service ride-sharing, but these internet-based brats are takers, not sharers, and the bulk of the fares they charge end up in the pockets of their faraway hedge fund owners. Still, they insist that they are new economy, tech-driven geniuses that are above the fusty old local laws that other transportation companies follow. So Uber and Lyft have made it a corporate policy to throw hissy fits when cities from Los Angeles to Atlanta, Houston to Portland, have dared even to propose that they obey rules to protect customers and drivers. The latest tantrum from the California giants came in Austin when the city council adopted a few modest, perfectly reasonable rules. The petulant duo then used high-pressure tactics to force a special election to overturn the council's action. Being brats, they assumed that locals would flock to do whatever the popular service wanted. But they picked the wrong city. First, they ran a campaign of blatant lies, as though Austinites wouldn't question them. Then, they shoved a sickening level of corporate cash into their campaign, apparently thinking that the sheer tonnage of mendacious ads would win the day for them. However, the slicks from California turned out to be Uber goobers. Despite spending $9 million, more than the combined spending of all city council candidates in the past decade, they went down 56% to 44%. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Uber and Lyft have now left town in a huff. But who needs them? A new Texas-based upstart called GetMe has already moved in to fill the void with community spirit rather than pouty corporate arrogance, saying it's happy to comply with sensible rules that the people want.
Millions of workers in the U.S. who currently don't qualify for overtime pay, despite putting in more than 40 hours a week, will soon see a spike in their paycheck. After years of resistance from powerful business lobbies, the Department of Labor announced new rules on Tuesday. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Millions of white-collar workers in the United States will effectively get a raise by the end of the year under new Department of Labor rules announced Tuesday. According to the Economic Policy Institute, 12.5 million middle-class salaried workers stand to benefit from the new rules. Many are women, people of color, or workers without advanced degrees. Working overtime used to result in a nice little paycheck bump at the end of the week and could help make an otherwise inadequate paycheck sufficient. But that's changed over time as inflation has exceeded wage hikes and as employers have increasingly moved hourly workers to lower middle-class level salaries, making them ineligible for overtime pay.
The rule we're announcing today is going to try to put things back together a little bit, updating the overtime protections for millions of workers.
At a press event in Ohio, Vice President Joe Biden explained the new rules make fewer salaried workers exempt from overtime pay. The rules affect low-end salaried supervisors and managers who currently don't qualify for overtime if they make more than $23,660 a year. That's the equivalent of $455 per week or $11.37 an hour. Yet many work long hours, effectively lowering their hourly pay rate, sometimes even below the minimum wage. Simply put, they work 50, 60, even 70 hours, but get paid for 40. Under the new rules, the salary threshold is nearly doubled, making millions more workers eligible for overtime pay. Vice President Biden also predicted a boost to the economy.
There's $12 billion more dollars over the next 10 years will go into the economy to people who will spend it all, If I gave another $12 billion tax break over 10 years to people making over $1 million a year, whether they deserved it or not, if that happened, they're not going to go out and spend that immediately. They save it. They invest it in high. They don't go out and spend it. But this means there's going to be more people working at the soda fountain, more people at the movie theater, more people at the beauty salon. It means people are going to go spend this money. Because let me tell you something. If you're making $25,000, $35,000 a year, you don't have any disposable income after you meet your basic needs. So all this goes back in the economy.
Tuesday, a coalition of business groups appealed to Congress in a letter urging lawmakers to block the new rules. They say workers will lose benefits that go along with their salaried positions, like flex time and health care. The overtime rules fall under the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, which has been updated on occasion to raise the threshold, but has not kept up with inflation. The new rules will be automatically indexed to adjust for inflation and take effect December 1st, just weeks before President Obama leaves office. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
On Tuesday, foreign ministers of several nations met in Vienna, Austria, in an attempt to jumpstart talks to find a political solution to the Syrian civil war. The meeting was led by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, also included Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Stefan de Mistura, the United Nations envoy to Syria. Representatives of the 17 member nations of the International Syria Support Group were also in attendance. The last round of peace talks in Geneva stalled in late April when the Syrian opposition delegation walked out. The Assad regime is not party to the talks, but its close allies, Russia and Iran, are at the table even as they continue lending air support to the regime. Tuesday's meeting saw a few concrete results beyond a familiar commitment to a political settlement which calls for a united, non-sectarian Syria. However, despite setting a settlement deadline of August 1st, the attendees couldn't even agree on a date to restart the peace talks in Geneva. And there was no progress made towards bolstering a fragile ceasefire that began this February and has largely dissipated since late April, with hundreds of civilians being killed in airstrikes being conducted by the Syrian regime and Russian forces.
Would you personally accept people fleeing war or persecution into your country? Amnesty International just released the results of a survey asking this question and several others to 27,000 people in 27 countries. The results? China, Germany, and the UK rounded out the top three most welcoming countries, in that order. The least welcoming country? Russia. 46% of people surveyed in China said they would personally accept people fleeing war or persecution into their own homes. Overall, the survey concludes that 80% of the world's population is willing to welcome refugees into their countries. While some, like Germany and Canada, have made good on their promise to resettle Syrian refugees, the U.S. lags far behind. The U.S. has settled just over 1,700 Syrian refugees, far short of the 10,000 goal set by President Obama by September 2016. Frustrated by the slow pace, 27 Democratic senators sent a letter to Obama asking him to speed up the process and, quote, devote the necessary resources to expeditiously and safely resettle refugees from Syria.
In Sri Lanka, 3 days of heavy rains have resulted in devastating landslides. Most of them happened on Wednesday. Entire villages were buried under the mud. Rescue workers are trying to recover bodies from several locations, but over 100 are still missing and feared dead. The landslides hit about 70 miles outside of the capital of Sri Lanka, Colombo. Sri Lanka's Red Cross documented flash floods in almost all of the country's 25 districts. The monsoon season has only just begun, and exceedingly harsh rains are expected throughout the summer because of the lingering effects of El Niño. Continued rain showers stall the rescue process, and they also leave a threat of more landslides in the future.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jordan Fink, Jamie Haddad, Nicole Little, Rachel Miller Howard, Emery Mort, and Kanan Schlesinger. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jamie Haddad.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, May 20th, on KBOO, tune in at 7 for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, the guest host, Linda Olsen Osterlund, speaks with Eddie Gillis of Raging Grannies about her experience at Break Free in Anacortes this past week. At 9 on Veterans Voice, host Marvin Simmons talks about books, articles, and movies about the war in Vietnam. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support in our spring membership drive. You are the best.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Stay tuned now for an in-depth look at the new Burgerville Workers Union from KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger, who was on the scene when the union confronted management at Burgerville headquarters last week.
Standing on a patch of grass just outside of a Starbucks in downtown Vancouver, Washington, a gathering of workers and community organizers form clusters, bunch together, engage in conversation. It looks like an impromptu activist mixer, but it is anything but impromptu, and has nothing to do with Starbucks. A man comes forward and introduces himself as Lewis, and calls everyone together. Lewis is a fast food worker at Oregon and Washington local franchise Burgerville. He is one of many that have chosen to organize and form what has recently been revealed as the Burgerville Workers Union. The union's been formed to improve working conditions in restaurants and get a living wage for the workers. The loudest change being demanded is a wage increase of $5 an hour, but they're also calling for other improvements in health and safety in the workplace. Lewis explains why he and other Burgerville Workers Union members have called the gathering.
Very good at scheduling, safe and healthy workplace. And 2 weeks ago or so, we announced publicly that we formed a union and that we have a different vision for Burgerville. $5 more an hour, better health care, very good distance scheduling, safe and healthy workplace. And in response to that, for about a week and a half, management was silent, which was great. We were able to be there publicly in our shops as the union, standing with our coworkers, demonstrating our strength. And then on Friday, we received this letter with our paychecks. And the letter looked like they had Googled union busting and copied and pasted the first thing they found. It was intimidating, it was confusing, it talked about the union as a third party, it talked about how organizers were gonna come knocking at your door and distracting you at home, it talked about how there might be this scary thing called a union election, and Amy pointed out that there was a bunch of sentences bolded, and every sentence that was bolded had the phrase, "don't sign an authorization card" in it. So, the letter also had a very important point. It said that Burgerville does not agree that the union is in the interests of the employees in Burgerville, which they didn't have to say, right? They could have been vague, they could have been confusing, they could have tried to just stay on the fence, but they said clearly that they're against the union.
The Burgerville Workers Union responded to the letter issued by management by posting an infographic in the workplace in order to set the record straight and ease any misgivings that might have been spread by the company letter. Lewis explains what else happened that day.
And so, and then on the same day, we had a delegation of faith leaders saying that they stood with Burgerville and saying that they didn't stay, that they wanted Burgerville to choose a different path than this anti-union path they've been choosing. So we've gotten our friends together, and specifically we've gotten our friends in organizations together who represent even more friends. And we want to go to Burgerville and we want to tell them with strength, but with civility, that they're going down this path, that they don't have to continue down this path, that the door is still wide open, and that